welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We're glad you're with us, and we hope you had a wonderful weekend. Coming up in the second part of today's show, Dr. Art Malloy is the Vice President of Student Affairs at the University of North Dakota, and he sat down with Prairie Public's CEO John Harris in a recent edition of the Prairie Pulse television show to visit about the yearly February observance of Black History Month. And we begin Main Street today with Dr. Jim Higgins from the University of North Dakota. He's an aviation professor. His research focuses on statistical analysis, forecasting, safety data analysis, and operations research. And with multiple tragic air incidents since the start of just this year, we thought it would be wise to have him with us here on Main Street. Dr. Higgins, welcome.
Thank you for the invite today. I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
We are so glad that you are with us. First thing that I am interested in, Dr. Higgins, is what do you discuss with students when air crashes like this happen?
Well, when accidents like this occur, obviously it can have several different effects. You know, it's a small community from an aviation point of view, so it affects each of our students quite differently. In some cases, we have to monitor for mental health concerns, but most of the time, we're able to take a proactive look at what happened, you know, reflect upon what happened, and then after the investigation's complete, we'll be able to learn as a community, you know, what happened, what the precursors were, and what we could do to mitigate situations like that in the future. You know, obviously, these are catastrophes, and we've almost gone a whole generation without having one of these. And so we have a lot of students at our university and other places that haven't grown up with aircraft accidents like this. You know, they never were super common, but they certainly happened with more frequency in the 80s and the 90s and even the early 2000s. But, you know, from about 2008 to now, we just really haven't had too many of them. And so we have to reflect upon that as well and understand that a lot of people maybe didn't grow up with this. So we have to make sure that everyone has the right perspective.
Dr. Higgins, given the high profile nature of these crashes and the tragedy, really, how would you assess today the overall state of aviation safety in the United States?
Well, certainly these have grabbed the public's attention, and rightly so, because they are very unusual. And in the case of the accident, you know, we had a loss of life, which of course is catastrophic. And you know, we all think about the families and the victims and the crews and all the people, the first responders that were affected by this. And also it hurts our collective psyche, you know, as a country and as a worldwide community. So we always take a look at that first, but we also have to keep a much broader perspective on things. Since the last accident in 2009 in Buffalo, New York, you know, we've transported as an industry in the United States billions of passengers without you know, anyone being killed. And the good news with that is it puts us even more favorable than Powerball lottery odds. So to put it in perspective, even today, even with these most recent high-profile events, a passenger in the United States flying on a United States-certified air carrier airline has a better chance of winning the Powerball lottery by about a factor of 13, by the way. They have a
Wow.
better chance, 13 times better chance than they do of dying on that aircraft that day. So the odds are very much, you know, very much in favor, and it's still an extremely safe industry. I understand with the attention that this grabs, it may make people nervous, and that's understandable. But I can assure everyone listening that there's never been a safer industry that you can operate in.
So I would assume then that it would be accurate to say that you've not observed any trends in these recent accidents that point to systematic issues in air traffic control or aircraft operations. Is that accurate?
That's very accurate. You know, we do monitor for trends. The FAA and the industry together monitor for trends. There's a group called the Commercial Air Safety Team, which is a group of industry people and FAA regulators and a bunch of scientists, academia, and we do monitor for trends. We bring in all the data throughout all these, you know, every aircraft that flies in the United States produces data, and that data goes in, and we analyze it, and we do look for trends. We do look for exceedances, and we do look for events that might be indicative of a potential future problem. And I can tell you with quite certainty that there are no disturbing trends. Obviously, we've had two accidents that are high profile, and so people listening might be like, "Oh, I don't believe that." But I'm telling you, just from a pure data point of view, We have not seen any unsettling trends or anything that is of concern. Apart from the fact that we did have, you know, we have had some catastrophic accidents, and we have to go in and investigate those, learn what went wrong, take the information we learned, and make sure when we identify any accident precursors that we put in proper mitigations and defenses against them so that this does not happen again in the future. But that being said, there are no current trends or anomalies or anything that is of concern.
Dr. Higgins, immediately after the January 29th accident near Reagan National Airport in Washington, that was when an American Airlines passenger jet collided midair with the U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter over the Potomac and led to the death of 67 individuals who were on board both aircraft. I read the Associated Press, and the headline was this: Trump targets FAA diversity efforts in plane crash probe, despite no evidence they played any role. What is your perspective about those comments?
Well, I watched that press conference with President Trump shortly after the accident, and quite frankly, I was disappointed. Look, it's human nature to want to know what happened, and if you go online and read social media, there's a lot of people out there that are pretty sure they know what happened in each of these accidents. Having been in aviation now for, you know, I grew up in an aviation family. You know, my father was an airline pilot. My wife's a pilot. My brother's a pilot. I've grown up in this. I've studied accidents for years. We've studied them at the university. I'm a former airline pilot. I've landed in Toronto and in Reagan National many, many times myself with passengers. And I don't even know what's happened in these at all. But it is human nature to want to know. And that's good. But we have to let the investigation play out. And I know that frustrates people when they hear that. But the truth is we need to be after the truth. We have to know what happened, and we have to go at it from an unemotional, data-driven point of view. We owe it to the people that lost their lives. We owe it to everybody that flies in the future to learn what went wrong and make sure we don't repeat that. And unfortunately, people lost their lives. But we will get some critical safety information off of that. We don't know what it is. I can tell you the diversity and inclusion talk, in my opinion, having been in this industry for a very long time, I don't see a place for that. The people that get certified to operate, whether it's an air traffic controller or a line pilot, a mechanic, a dispatcher, any of these certificated positions, they have to go through an incredible amount of training just to show up at an airline and get a job as a pilot, for instance. You're looking at years and years of primary training and studying and going through all kinds of check rides and checking events. Most airlines require a college degree, and there's all things like that. And then once you get to the airline, you have to go through an incredible amount of training to make sure that you can fly that very specific aircraft. And even once you prove that you can fly it, you're supervised for many, many hours by a special captain. And that's one of the things I used to do in the industry as well. I was a line check airman. And what we would do is we would help new hires learn how to fly in the environment. So by the time somebody is there with passengers, unsupervised, ready to land an aircraft, they've gone through years and years of training. And I can tell you in all of these accidents, including the one in Washington, D.C., and the one that just happened in Toronto, I can tell you these pilots were fully trained. They passed all of the check rides and checking events and all of the safety measures put in place. And so they were fully qualified. Obviously, something went wrong, right? There was certainly something within the system that went wrong. And we have to find out what that was. But I can tell you, these pilots were not out of the ordinary. There was nothing specially done to put them in the positions that they were in, any of the pilots on any of these aircraft. They all had earned their way there. They all had passed all the check rides. It's rigorous. You know, for people that start out learning how to fly on their own in the United States, they start out with what's called a private pilot certificate. It's about 1 in 10 that make it to even become a private pilot. And then from there, the odds just go a lot less. So by the time you're flying a commercial jetliner in the United States, you've gone through an unbelievable vetting process just to get to that point. I'm just telling you, as someone that's been in the industry for a very, very long time, I just don't buy the diversity and inclusion stuff as a factor in any of these accidents. And I think eventually the investigations will certainly bore that out.
Dr. Higgins, one of the things that I have thought about over the years, and again recently, is air traffic control staffing shortages that we've heard about from time to time. Now, I think we've introduced FAA layoffs. Do you worry that those might play a role in the future in aviation safety? And how concerning are these factors to you?
Well, we have to look at who's getting laid off. Now, there's no doubt we have a controller shortage in the United States. There's just no doubt about that. There's no way to say anything other than that. And one of the reasons why is it's a very hard job. Most people that start out trying to be an air traffic controller, quite frankly, they don't make it to a full position certified position. It can take, once you go through your initial training to be an air traffic controller, it can take up to 2 years to get to where you're, again, on your own. And that's after a lot of training. And a lot of people just don't cut it. It's just not for everybody. You have to be really smart. You have to be really, really good with three-dimensional thinking, what we call spatial intelligence. I mean, I know that sounds pretty obvious, but not everyone's born with that. And you do have to have that as a human. You have to have that ability to be able to look at things like that critically and you know, problem solve. And so it is true that if you want to make a criticism of the FAA, and I think there are places you can, I think that they have not hired enough air traffic controllers in the previous years, and they've not kept up with the retirements. Air traffic controllers in a federal facility have to retire at age 55, for instance. You know, and so there's things like that the FAA could do a better job. As far as who's getting laid off and furloughed, we'd really have to take a look at that. I've worked with the FAA for years on research projects and on working groups. And as far as I know, and this is a very anecdotal piece, the people I know that I work with in the safety side of things, none of them have been affected with any of the job layoffs. I think a lot of it is maybe more on the management side. I mean, the FAA has had difficulty, in my opinion, bringing in next gen, which is a new, a lot of new technologies. What I would say your UAS integration, they're making good steps there, but they could do a better job, in my opinion. And so I think maybe some of the people that have been working on some of those political questions, more political, more bureaucratic questions, maybe they're the ones that are being laid off. I don't know. But if there are any air traffic control folks being laid off or any direct safety people, inspectors, technicians, things like that, then that would be a cause for concern.
Relative to how these accidents are investigated, I would assume the FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board have primary responsibilities in doing so. Do you have any concerns that because of the number of accidents that we've had, that they don't have the necessary resources and even maybe the authority to investigate, report, and prevent future crashes?
Well, the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, has primary jurisdiction over all accidents that occur in the United States and U.S. territories. And they have several members that are trained accident investigators. And I've been to Ashburn, where they do their training at the NTSB Academy. And these are highly trained professionals, in my opinion, the best in the world at what they do. They are resourced to handle this. Now, what a lot of people probably don't know, and I don't know if this is a good thing to say or not, but I'm just going to say it. The smaller aircraft that you see flying around, like the Cessnas and the Pipers, the 4-seat and the 6-seat and the 2-seat aircraft, the truth is we have about 1,000 accidents a year with those. So 2 to 3 times a day, there's other aircraft accidents. The ones that we're talking about caught the public attention. Obviously, the airline air carrier group, the jets, they don't crash with anywhere near that frequency at all. But the NTSB is tasked with investigating all of these accidents. In some cases, they will have the FAA come in and also do an investigation. And in some really rare cases where there aren't people that are hurt, they'll even rely on local, they'll let local law enforcement make a report, if no one had hurt and no one got hurt or there wasn't any property damage, et cetera. So, no, I don't have a concern about that. I know a lot of the NTSB folks. I've testified before the NTSB board in D.C. These are highly trained individuals, and they will get to the bottom of these things. If anything, if there ever is a resource issue, the way that would play out, in my opinion, would be there may be a little bit of a longer investigation period, but the evidence will be, meticulously looked upon, and they'll go through their processes that they've trained on for years. And I have no doubt they'll get to the bottom of these things.
We are enjoying our conversation with Dr. Jim Higgins. He's from the University of North Dakota, where he is a professor in aviation. Dr. Higgins, what are the biggest challenges in regional and rural aviation safety that maybe have surfaced recently or that you've thought about, particularly in places like North Dakota, where weather and geography can create additional risks?
Well, there any airline in the United States that carries passengers, 19 passengers or more, they're certified under what we call FAR 121 regulations. And so there's one level of safety, whether it's a small commuter jet with 50 people or a large wide body with, 300 people. The pilots, the aircraft, the maintenance, the way the airline is run, that all has the same exact requirements by the FAA. Now, when you do get into more remote areas, for instance, in Alaska and other remote areas, you sometimes fly under a different type of regulation called 135. And this just refers to the part of the U.S. code that certifies different air carriers. It's a risk-based system. So obviously, when you fly less passengers, the risk is a little bit less, when you look at it from a system point of view. So the rules might be a little bit different. Well, they are different between the 135 and the 121. Personally, I do think we could do a better job in the 135 realm and increase our standards in some of those areas. But this is just my personal opinion. I have worked on groups in the FAA, and there's a lot of people that agree with me. And I think that you're going to start seeing more efforts in that place, especially as technology gets better. We'll be able to start bringing the standards up everywhere.
We've all heard about the proliferation of drones, and I'm curious of other key factors that you believe affects our travel today. Runway safety, airspace coordination, I guess especially at busy urban airports, but even at rural airports like we have here in North Dakota.
Whenever there's like a delay, for instance, you're sitting on a plane and you're in the tarmac or it's taxied out and it's sitting there, or maybe you didn't even make it to the plane, you're sitting in an airport terminal looking at your plane, and you hear things like the pilots aren't here yet, the flight attendant's not here yet, there's weather, there's ATC delays, all the things that we hear when we travel. Well, the truth of the matter is the reason why there are delays and the reason why there are cancellations is they're almost always safety-based. The airline is not going to take a chance. The FAA is not going to take a chance. If you don't have well-rested pilots, for instance, rested per the regulations, they're not going to take the flight. If the plane has a mechanical incident that needs to be inspected, replaced, or worked on, they're not going to take the flight. It's very frustrating from a passenger point of view when your plane's delayed, especially if you had something critical that you needed to get to. But that being said, the reason why this exists, it is for safety. In the case of North Dakota, we are in a rural environment, and it is difficult. I live in Grand Forks, and we do have service here on Delta and Allegiant, and, that's great to have. But the truth is I often have to drive to Fargo if I want to go west, for instance, to go to Denver on United or Dallas on American or something like that. With the pilot shortages that have occurred in the past, and now, of course, we're in aircraft shortages because of the problems with Boeing and the problems with Airbus and their engines, we're not seeing the industry keep pace in terms of growth. So I think you are probably going to see, you're going to continue to see this what we call regionalization, which means that people may have to drive for an hour or two. And certainly if you're in the western part of North Dakota, this is, you're no stranger to this, but you may have to drive for an hour or two just to get to an airport that has the service to get to where you want to go. That is a problem. If I'm just being candid with your listeners, I don't think that's going away anywhere soon. I think that might have to be fixed. Maybe that's more of a 5 to 10 year window to fix that. But what I do want to remind everyone is the reason for these delays and not having the oversaturation is because we're trying to keep a very good risk margin and maintain our safety standards within the industry. So when a plane's delayed because of weather, they're not joking. It's because the weather's not where they need it to be to get as many aircraft in the system, and they're just not going to take that risk. And that's also why we have those better than Powerball lottery odds that you're going to die on a flight. Flight may not go, or it may go late, but you're going to be very safe when it goes.
How do you plan, I guess, for emerging aviation technologies such as AI, enhanced GPS, or next generation air traffic control systems to improve safety? Are those some things that you are contemplating even today?
Well, yes. At the University of North Dakota, we work on a lot of those initiatives. There is a lot of great technology that is being thought about, and in some cases even being implemented and tested. And, the system's getting better and better. What I will say, and again, some would call this bureaucratic, some would call this cautious, some would call this whatever. When there is a new piece of technology, it takes years for the FAA to allow it to, completely integrate into the airspace system. Now, in some cases, that probably isn't a good thing because the technology could really help. In other cases, it's probably a very good thing because the new technology could also introduce confusion and, issues like that. And sometimes it's very expensive with new technology. And there are countless examples of that. So, you know, do I think that we could have a little bit of a faster pace with some of the new pieces of technology, the automation, the AI assist you're talking about, and some of these endeavors? I think absolutely it probably could go a little bit faster, truth be told. But I would not be the person to say, come on, let's go. Let's push this through as fast as we possibly can. Because we've learned over the years that when you do that, you can sometimes have unintended consequences, or what people like myself in the safety business, we call them dangerous defenses. They can occur. And we have to be very careful with that. So we do have to do a lot of good due diligence. We have to go through what are called safety risk assessments, SRAs, to make sure when we introduce something new, whether it's a new piece of technology or a new procedure or a new way to train, we have to make sure that it's going to have the desired result.
Dr. Higgins, I had a senator friend of mine in the Wyoming legislature who owned an air charter company. Tell me this. He said, soon, and I'm using that in air quotes, there'll be two entities in a cockpit, a pilot and a dog. The pilot's job will be to feed the dog, and the dog's job will be to bite the pilot if he touches anything. And the idea there is that autonomous travel is coming. Do you think we'll see that?
Well, I have to tell you, you know, obviously from a pilot-centric point of view, former airline pilot, I hope not anytime soon. And let me explain to you why. I do think that obviously our technology is getting amazing. You know, I was flying the line in the late 90s when they introduced the concept of Autoland. And I remember thinking to myself, boy, I wonder how this is going to handle a stiff crosswind. Well, it turns out the Autoland systems do quite a good job with stiff crosswinds. However, right now, our best system to, you know, and I would argue that the proof is in the data. The best system we have are two well-trained individuals that can monitor the situation. And, you know, if one person's making a mistake or if the automation's making a mistake, that, you know, there's a very good chance, you know, that one of the trained aviators on board will be able to spot that. So I do think that, you know, we're generations away from having full-blown automation like that. You know, again, some people may disagree, but I, you know, even with the latest, you know, ChatGPT, or I guess Twitter X just released this thing called Grok 3, which apparently is really good. I haven't tried it yet, but we still have this big problem with AI, especially these large language models. They hallucinate at times. And when they can't figure something out, they just make stuff up. That's funny when you're having it write a story for you. It could be really funny because you're like, hey, look what AI wrote. Not so funny when you have it flying on the flight deck of an aircraft and it hallucinates. So we're not there yet at all. And we're at least a generation or two away, in my opinion, before you start wholesale allowing automation to completely fly. One last piece, as we see the proliferation of self-driving cars, I do think sociologically speaking, people will become, and I mean, I hate to stereotype, but probably the younger generations will lead this. They'll become more comfortable with automation. And then you may start seeing passengers become more accepting. But I do believe we're still a few generations before we have what we call blind trust in the automation.
As we wrap up our conversation, Dr. Higgins, are there policy or procedural changes that you're advocating for that we should consider to prevent similar accidents than we've seen here at the start of this year?
Well, on these particular accidents, you know, I'm going to wait until the investigation comes up with the causes. That being said, I will tell you that we are the industry as a whole, the FAA as the rule maker, they are continually looking at these things. You know, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, which technology should we have in place, which one shouldn't we? You know, for instance, in the DC area, helicopters are no longer allowed to fly along the Potomac River anymore for obvious reasons, and that's their fix now until they basically reduce that risk to zero. I mean, the only way to reduce a risk to zero is to not have that operation. And so that's what they've done. As far as like any standing regulations, the only thing I would say is, and this is a whole nother thing that we can talk about some other day, Craig, but what I would say is there are some mental health issues that pilots face. And I would like to see the FAA allow pilots to get more mental health help when they need it. Including, you know, acceptable medications. And the FAA has made work. They have, it used to be, you know, even 10 years ago, if you had any kind of a mental health condition, you couldn't come near an aircraft. And you can understand, you can probably understand from the FAA's point of view why they want to de-risk that and keep that near zero. But the truth is, pilots are just like anyone. They're your neighbors, right? Everyone goes through things in life where they may have some mental health challenges. And, you know, they're very good pilots, but they're hitting a rough spot. And so if I was to call for anything, this is me personally, but I know a lot of my colleagues and a lot of people believe in this in general. I would like to see the FAA do more work in allowing pilots to get mental health help when they need it and get them back in the cockpit where they're, you know, good, safe pilots that they were before and will be in the future. That doesn't have anything to do with any of these accidents as far as I know, but just under the auspices of just making sure I answer your question, is there anything I'm calling for? That would be about it.
Is the United States still the safest country in the world to fly in?
No doubt about it. Our safety record is there's other countries that are great and very, very safe, but just statistically with the amount of operations that we do, 13.6 trillion passenger miles between these accidents, it's very safe.
Dr. Jim Higgins has been my guest. He's a professor of aviation at the University of North Dakota. Dr. Higgins, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us here on Main Street.
Well, thank you as well. I sure appreciate the time.
There's more to come. After the break, Dr. Art Malloy, Vice President of Student Affairs at the University of North Dakota, sits down with Prairie Public's CEO John Harris in a recent edition of the Prairie Pulse television show. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In a recent episode of Prairie Pulse on the television service of Prairie Public, Dr. Art Malloy, the Vice President of Student Affairs at the University of North Dakota, visited with Prairie Public's CEO John Harris about the yearly February observance of Black History Month.
We're glad to have you here today.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here also.
Well, you're here today to talk about Black History Month. Tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I'm originally from North Carolina, a little small city called Dunn. I have been in higher education for more than 3 decades. I've received my education in three different places. Shaw University, the oldest historically Black university in the South, and that's in Raleigh, North Carolina. A BA in film and television, and then my master's degree from Ohio State University. I didn't say the Ohio State. My master's degree was in African American history with a focus on politics and economics. And then I went to the University of Georgia and got my doctorate in higher education management.
Tell us about your job at UND, Vice President of Student Affairs.
Well, I started my career teaching African American history at Shaw University. Did that for about 2.5 years. And then I pivoted and went into student affairs, and that is my passion, has been my passion for a long time. And finally made my way, after working at several different universities, finally made my way to the University of North Dakota. As Vice President for Student Affairs, I'm the Chief Student Affairs Officer, and I've been the Chief Student Affairs Officer at other institutions also. At Savannah College of Art and Design, I was there for about 12 years. And then I was at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke as the Chief Student Affairs Officer just before coming to the University of North Dakota. And what I do, I have the privilege of working with a bunch of talented men and women who love students. And our goal is to make sure that we prepare our students to lead when they leave the University of North Dakota. And we do that in a variety of ways. We do it in our residence halls by making sure that they know how to live with each other, that they know how to resolve conflict. We also do it by making sure that they understand how to attend to their own wellness. And that may be if working with our counseling center, making sure that they are looking after their own nutrition in our dining halls. It means perhaps spending time in our wellness center. Just a variety of things that we do deliberately from the time the students meet with us for orientation until the time they walk across the stage for graduation. We just want to make sure that the process of student development begins as soon as they arrive, and that they leave us better than they were when they showed up.
Well, we've asked you today to talk to us about Black History Month. Can you give us and talk about the origins of Black History Month and why February?
Well, Black History Month, for those who've looked into it, is a month that was put forward by Carter G. Woodson. And Carter G. Woodson is often referred to as the father of Black history. He actually chose the month of February back in 1926. He chose the month of February to have what he was calling at the time Negro History Week. He chose the second week of February because the second week of February is the week that we celebrate the birthdays of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. That's how it started in 1926. 50 years later, in 1976, it was recognized by, I believe, President Gerald Ford, and it was recognized federally as one of the months that would be recognized. That's how we got to where we are today, from Negro History Week to Black History Month. And next year, in 2026, we'll be celebrating 100 years of celebrating Black history in the United States.
Is this a month only observed in the United States, or do other countries or areas in the world observe anything like this?
It is observed in some other places. I can tell you for sure that it is observed unofficially all over the Caribbean. It is observed in a couple of other countries. It is observed in the UK, and I think they've been observing it since the 1980s. It is also observed in Ireland, of all places. It is also observed in Canada, and it's observed unofficially again in France, because France has a large African population.
Can you talk about this year's theme, African Americans and labor? Tell us about that, and why is that important?
Well, it is very important, and I would say for obvious reasons. When the slaves were brought here in the Middle Passage, millions of slaves brought to the United States in the Middle Passage, there was a reason to bring them here. And that reason was because they were going to be utilized as a source of labor. And at the time that they were brought here, the economy was basically based on agriculture. So they were needed to work the fields. They were needed to work on farms. And it's a mischaracterization to think that everyone in the United States owned slaves. The only people that owned slaves were the people that could afford them. And these were normally the more well-to-do individuals who were here. So slaves were not everywhere, but they were on the large plantations, they were on the large farms, but they were a source of labor. So it does make sense to me that labor is one of the themes, but we can talk about when the slaves first arrived here and the economy was basically based on agriculture. As time progressed and we moved into things like the Industrial Revolution and with the onset of the cotton gin, which you would think if you had the cotton gin and the cotton gin was mass produced, that there would be less of a need for slaves, actually wasn't the case. Because the cotton was so popular, and one of the things that was being imported back to Europe, there was a higher demand than what anybody believed was going to be the case. So they had to go and get even more slaves after the cotton gin. And then we moved right up into the Industrial Revolution, and you had slaves who were actually forced to work and to build factories. You had slaves who were there, and they were another source of labor for every aspect of the Industrial Revolution. And I guess that's a good thing, because they were actually learning. They were learning some skills then, but that was sort of short-lived, and it was short-lived because the Industrial Revolution also brought a lot of Europeans who were looking for a better life here in what they called the New World.
Can you talk some about, I guess there's some distinctions in this year's theme, free versus unfree and skilled versus unskilled. Why are those distinctions important?
Well, I think those distinctions are important because throughout the history of Blacks in the country, there would be a couple of categorizations. One, free versus unfree. Free after emancipation, unfree prior to emancipation, but facing the same issues. And that is that the slaves didn't own anything. slaves were going to have to work for someone. They were owned. And then after the slaves were emancipated, they still ran into issues because by the time they were emancipated, we were coming right up upon the time of the Industrial Revolution. So now they were having to compete for jobs, even though they learned how to do some of these jobs when the Industrial Revolution began. Now they had to compete with immigrants who were coming over from Europe. If you talk to most historians, what they will tell you is that America was built with a lot of the manpower from slaves. They're going to tell you that the railroads were built by slaves. I would say the railroads were built by slaves, but they were also built by a lot of the Chinese who had come over just to work on the railroads. It's been an interesting time because after the Industrial Revolution, we went right into what we call the Great Migration, and that's when blacks were leaving the South and moving to the North, and they were looking for jobs that required skill. Some of them already had some of those skills, but they were moving to places where they could also be trained how to utilize the types of skills to do things like building cars, but also building the infrastructure for some of America's largest cities also.
Well, you mentioned being, of course, in North Carolina, Georgia, and Ohio State. Can you talk about the changes you've seen? Mainly, when I ask that, probably more in the Deep South in your lifetime.
Well, I can tell you, when I was born, segregation was still the rule of the day. So I do remember, as I was delivering newspapers, I do remember seeing faucets that were designated for coloreds. I saw outhouses. I don't know if you know what outhouses are here, but outhouses that were also designated for coloreds. So I've seen a great deal of change since then. By the time it was time for me to go to schools, I was going to integrated schools. I think that there's been a great deal of progress in the South. The one thing about being in the South, if a person did not like you, they told you that they didn't like you. If they didn't want you around, they told you that they didn't want you around. And I think when I was growing up, I had respect for that. If you didn't want me to be there, then I didn't want to be where I wasn't wanted. I think now, because so many of the kids went to school with each other, relationships have gotten to the point where we're used to being around each other. You don't necessarily have to like each other, but as long as you are respectful of each other. And I think what you're going to find in the South is that people are nice. And if they don't want to be bothered with you, they will let you know.
Is it important to teach sort of all history in schools, not just the European American point of view?
Yes. Here's what I think about black history. You can't talk about black history without talking about American history. You can't talk about American history without talking about black history. And you can't talk about the history of America without talking about all of the different groups that are represented here. It is important, you know, if you're going to talk about someone like Thomas Edison, if you're going to talk about what Edison was able to do with the light bulb, if you're going to talk about Alexander Graham Bell and what Alexander Graham Bell was able to do with the telephone, you also have to talk about Louis Latimer, who is the common denominator between the two of them. Yes, Edison, his invention was his own invention, but he did have some help. And I think as we talk about black history, and one of the reasons why it's important for me to continue to talk about black history is because I want to make sure that everyone gets the full story. There have been a lot of people that have contributed to making America the great country that it is. Some of us are black, some of us are white, some of us are Asian, some of us are of Latin descent, some of us are indigenous people, some of us are women, some of us are LGBTQ. A lot of us have done that. And so that's the reason why I think it's important to celebrate these awareness months. And I don't want to just celebrate one. I think we have to celebrate them all. And if we celebrate them all, and it's truly a celebration of what makes America great. And you don't have to celebrate one by putting another down. I've always simply believed that when you teach the real history of America, that you're teaching the history that's inclusive of all the people who've made it what it is.
What about some current or past African Americans who've inspired you? You said you want to celebrate them all, but now I'm putting you on the spot to name a few or a couple.
I would say first, it's easy for me to start with Martin Luther King. I think that's a name that everyone's going to recognize, Martin Luther King. But I also recognize Martin Luther King's mentor, A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph is a name that is not very widely known. And when we talk about the March on Washington that happened in the 1960s, that wasn't the first March on Washington. The first March on Washington was in 1941, and A. Philip Randolph was the organizer of that march. So when you look at pictures of the March on Washington in the 1960s, what you're going to see is the person who is beside King is A. Philip Randolph. So A. Philip Randolph is a hero to me. He's a person who continues to inspire me. Of course, you know, I would say Martin Luther King. I would even say Malcolm X, but I would say Malcolm X, the changed Malcolm X after he left prison, because he was not afraid to stand up for that which he believed in, and he ended up dying for that too. So even Barack Obama, I think Barack Obama is a very inspirational figure for me. And if you know me, then most people know that I was the teaching assistant for Manning Marable. Marable is also one of those persons.
If people want more information, maybe find out what's going on in Black History Month around the region or at the university, where can they go?
If they want to know what's going on at the University of North Dakota, they can go to our website and they can put in the Hilliard Center and they will find out what's going on there. I also know that our colleagues at North Dakota State University, they have some events that are going on also. There are events that are going on in Grand Forks at the Empire Art Center also. So I would say look at their websites also.
Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Art Malloy, the Vice President of Student Affairs at the University of North Dakota, with Prairie Public's CEO John Harris in a recent episode of Prairie Pulse. Prairie Pulse airs on the television service of Prairie Public Weekly and is our public affairs program featuring newsmakers, interviews, and artist profile stories. Tune in on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Central or stream episodes online.
Dakota Geriatrics presents Age-Friendly Healthcare for American Indian Elders Virtual Symposium, February 28th from 7:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. for healthcare providers and community workers working with American Indian populations. Learn more at dakotageriatrics.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and in this episode of Natural North Dakota, Chuck Lura invites listeners to explore the winter night sky, especially with a new moon fast approaching on the 28th. It's an ideal time to stargaze and discover the mythology behind celestial formations.
Are you up for checking out the night sky? Whether you're familiar with the winter constellations, interested in learning a few, or just want to gaze up at the cosmos, the next few nights might be a great time to do so if the sky is clear. That's because there's a new moon coming up on the 28th, and of course it could also be good for several nights after the new moon as well. The stars are quite prominent during a new moon, and some of the constellations are easy to identify. They include Orion the Hunter, Taurus the Bull, Lepus the Hare, and Canis Major and Canis Minor, the Big Dog and Little Dog. And of course, there's the Big Dipper and Little Dipper. Orion's one of the more easily identified winter constellations. Orion, you may recall, was a prominent character in Greek mythology, known for being a great hunter and ladies' man. Look up in the southern sky around 9 o'clock, roughly halfway up and perhaps a bit to the west. Look for four bright stars forming a crude rectangle oriented somewhat vertically. That's Orion the Hunter. But there's more. Within that rectangle and near the middle, you'll see three prominent stars arrayed in a row, roughly equidistant and dipping to the left. That's Orion's belt. You may also note a couple stars in a hazy area below the belt. That's the Orion Nebula, the closest and most active area of star formation in the Milky Way. Lepus the Hare is directly below Orion. It's resting with its body horizontal to the horizon with its head to the right. Two stars should be visible that represent the ear sticking up, and the rump, off to the left, is a little larger than the rest of the body. To find Taurus the Bull, look for a very bright star to the upper right of Orion's belt. That's Aldebaran, a first magnitude star which marks the base of Taurus the Bull's head. Above Aldebaran are two prominent stars that represent the tips of his horns. In Greek mythology, Zeus took the form of a white bull, Taurus, to carry off the young princess Europa. To find Canis Major, the Big Dog, look for a very bright star, Sirius, to the lower left of Orion's belt line. Sirius represents the front shoulder of Canis Major, who's facing westward. The stars to the left of Sirius represent the body, legs, and tail. There's much more to observe in the winter sky, of course, including the planets, and there's a wealth of information available to assist you. I've also put links to a few sources of information, including star charts, along the script of this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Chuck Lura was a longtime biology professor at Dakota College at Botano, publishing research on ecological aspects of grasslands in the Northern Great Plains. In retirement, he continues to share his natural North Dakota essays for our Prairie Public audience.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 24th. On this date, in 1916, Wahpeton newspapers reported the arrest of a young couple on charges of fornication. Authorities suspected something far more sinister and began to question them further. The couple had checked into the Merchant's Hotel as Mr. and Mrs. St. Clair on Saturday, February 5th. By Monday, they had left by train. But on Thursday, a citizens' committee arrived seeking information about a baby the hotel proprietor claimed to have seen with them. The train conductor, however, said there was no baby when they boarded. Rumors spread across the state. 2 weeks earlier, a Fargo paper had published a sensational story about Mrs. Arthur Olson, who had been denied placement for her baby at the children's home. The paper reported that she had been driven out of Wahpeton by doctors after failing to pay her hospital bill and that her husband had been killed. She wanted to board the baby while she worked. The children's home superintendent wrote a letter to the paper clarifying that Mrs. Olson's request was not the home's purpose, but that they could assist her in finding a good home for adoption. Olson claimed her baby was born at Dr. Devine's hospital in Wahpeton 2 days after her husband's death. False information continued to circulate, prompting authorities to investigate. The couple was questioned separately by the state's attorney, but their stories didn't match. The girl said she had given the baby to a cousin. Robert Sinclair, the father, said to press charges. He told the girl he would leave the baby on a doorstep in Wahpeton, but that the child was in good hands and would be returned at trial. After further interrogation, Sinclair confessed to killing the baby on Sunday in a brutal and depraved manner. Sinclair took the body in a suitcase to an outhouse near the train depot where railroad section men later helped recover it. Both parents were shown the dead baby. The mother exclaimed, "If I had only known what he was going to do with it." A doctor testified that the mother seemed loving and that the baby was born at St. Francis Hospital in Breckenridge, Minnesota. She was not charged with murder, though public sympathy remained mixed regarding her knowledge of the crime. Sinclair was sentenced to 30 years, but was released after a year, reportedly in the final stages of tuberculosis. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on Main Street, I'll visit with author Kevin Howard. He wrote the book Onward at Last. He's a former banker turned sharp critic of capitalism, and he takes on America's obsession with wealth, individualism, and power, arguing that true prosperity lies in interdependence, not competition. Why do we measure success by money? That's all ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you can join us again.